I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
I believe you cannot say you are for peace and vote to keep this war going. You cannot say you are for peace and give the president money not just to keep this war going, but to attack Iran if he so chooses. If you want peace, vote for peace now. If you want peace, stop funding the war. If you want peace, stand for the truth. I yield back.
So.
Democratic presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich of Ohio in today's debate on the House bill that would finance the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, but would require combat troops to return home by September 2008 or sooner if the Iraqi government fails to meet benchmarks. Opponents include Republicans who feel the bill is too limiting on the president's powers, and Democrats like Kucinich who feel it gives the president too much. They want troops home now. But here is Pennsylvania Congressman John Murtha's response to critics of the bill, including fellow Democrats.
I knew over a year ago we didn't have the numbers of troops we needed to sustain this deployment, and the surge makes it worse. The worst thing we can do is send troops, and if you vote against this, you're going to vote for sending troops into war without the fully mission capable, without the training and equipment that they need.
Jonathan Allen is the Inside Congress reporter for Congressional Quarterly. John, what's going on? What's hitting you about today's debate?
Well, it's interesting. The Republicans just closed with Sam Johnson of Texas, a Vietnam veteran who was tortured in the Hanoi Hilton during the Vietnam War, and he argued against the president's hands being tied by a timeline. Just before him, Democrats had a speech by Patrick Murphy of Pennsylvania, who actually served in Iraq during the current war, about how important it is to pass this timeline to move toward withdrawal from Iraq. And I think that the timber today has been growing with every minute.
Right. Well, we've spoken about the strange bedfellows nature of the vote as well. As we said, liberal Democrats voting against the bill, as some pro-war Republicans are, because they both don't like it. Are there Republicans, you know, how many Republicans that you're hearing are breaking ranks? Because the Democrats obviously have this internal debate going on, but let's look at the Republicans. How many are breaking ranks?
Well, nearly all the Democrats will end up voting for this bill, and nearly all the Republicans will vote against it. It's not clear exactly how many Republicans will vote for it and help the Democrats and move for this timeline. I think that that there will be at least a handful. Whether that's less than half a dozen or a dozen, it's not quite clear yet.
So let's be clear. I mean, so you're saying that more Democrats than perhaps were thought earlier in the week, given war protesters sitting in their offices and such, more Democrats than previously thought are going to vote for the bill, even though they want troops home now and not a year from now.
That's right. There's a very limited number at this point of liberal Democrats who are prepared to vote against this bill. I think that there was a big moment for supporters of the bill earlier when MoveOn.org decided to get behind the bill. I think that provided a lot of cover for liberals who are against the war to vote for the bill. Even though they don't like continuing to fund the war, that was a big moment earlier this week.
Well, what is
Democratic leadership?
Well, there was also the White House also feels that items were put in the bill that had nothing to do with war funding, just to get some of these liberal Democrats to vote for it. What was said about those items, including money for spinach farmers and fisheries? We know there was an impassioned defense by a Democrat of a tunnel building program.
Right. Well, there's been a strong accusation from Republicans that Democrats have loaded this bill up with extraneous items to try to get votes, and no doubt a lot of those items, like the spinach farming provisions that you mentioned and some peanut provisions that you mentioned, as well as funding for refugee assistance in the Congo and all sorts of other items are attractive to Democratic members. I would say that the bill has not changed form in the last week, and even though it hasn't changed form in the last week, a lot of votes have come on board. So if deals are being cut, they're being cut outside the bill, it would seem, because it hasn't changed since it went through the Appropriations Committee, and yet a lot of votes have come on board since then.
And so, Jonathan, a couple seconds here. What's your sense? Will the bill pass?
I hope you don't replay this, but it looks like it's headed for that. Of course, the vote is going to happen in a few minutes here. And it should be fairly close. It should be fairly dramatic. But Democratic leaders are pretty confident that they have the votes, and typically they wouldn't bring it to the floor if they didn't.
Well, this is Washington, so we won't hold you to it, and we'll have the results in our newscast. John Allen, Inside Congress reporter for Congressional Quarterly. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
If you live in Clackamas County, Oregon, did you know Peggy Anderson? She joined the Marines the first year women could in 1943. She went skydiving at the age of 74, and she died last month at 85. We know that and much more today about Peggy because of her obituary in The Oregonian. It was written by Amy Martinez Stark, one of the many obit writers featured in the surprisingly delightful book The Deadbeat, which is just out in paperback. Did you know that as a child in Canada, the late economist John Kenneth Galbraith was such an avid reader, one of his most cherished memories is the day his local library changed its lending policy from 2 books every 2 weeks to unlimited borrowing, or that choirmaster and organist George Guest died. What kind of man was he? Well, he couldn't abide by ratatouille. It says so in his obituary. Walking the deadbeat is the phrase used in the business to describe the growing cult of people who scour the web and devour newspapers looking for obituaries. Marilyn Johnson is the author who tells their stories in The Deadbeat, Lost Souls, Lucky Stiffs, and The Perverse Pleasures of Obituaries. It's a tribute to a new form of journalism that's part short story, part memorial. At this week's end, we thought maybe something a little different, an uplifting aspect of death. We spoke with Marilyn Johnson when her book first came out and asked her to explain the draw of obituaries.
Well, I have the obituary for the New York Times in my hands. It runs 2 pages on the day that I'm looking at, and probably in all that sea of newsprint, there may be an inch and a half that tells you the bad news. The rest of it, great stories from life.
You begin by taking us with you to the 6th Great Obituary Writers International Conference. Who knew there was such a thing? Who are these people who attend?
Well, some of them are obituary editors, some are obituary writers, and some are people who just like to read obituaries and were willing to pay a nominal fee to attend the conference.
And what do they discuss? What is on the agenda at the Obituary Writers International Conference?
Everything. They discuss everything. A panel of people get up and talk about writing obituaries post 9/11. Someone else gets up and talks about how to cover the soldiers who are dying in Iraq. Whatever. It's marvelous.
Well, and we want to hear from some of these obituary writers who take their work very seriously. Jim Sheeler, for instance, who wrote for both the Denver Post and Rocky Mountain News, I think.
Yes.
He's one of what you refer to as egalitarian obituary writers. I'm looking at one of his just 2 simple lines. Agate, population 70, is one of those towns that people describe as blink and you'll miss it. Lois A. Engel loved living in the blink. I mean that would just pull you right in. Tell us about Jim Sheeler.
Jim Sheeler is much younger than some of us. He came out of journalism school, and the way he describes the thing that he does is, I almost produce my stories. So he wants to talk to people while they're doing the work that they're doing and having them tell about the lives of the people who they loved, who have gone. He's made it his special mission to remember the soldiers who've died in Iraq, and he's been covering all different angles there. He's been writing their obituaries, and he's been following some of the people who go and notify their relatives when they've died.
Did you have one that you can share with us?
Yes, I'd love to read from one that appeared in the Rocky Mountain News that's in the book. The silver van was spotted quickly as it slipped into town and turned up the old road that everyone here knows, raising questions and concern in its dust. One of the checkout clerks at the 90-year-old Hayden Mercantile was one of the first to see it and wonder. In a town of 1,634 people, it wouldn't be long before nearly everyone knew the weight of the news it carried. The van drove past downtown, past the houses with blue stars beckoning from the windows, signaling that the family has a son or daughter overseas. It drove past the old feed store and the silos and the history museum and the train depot. It drove past homes with a single American flag. and turned toward the place a bit farther out in the country where the flags sprout like wildflowers. It was the beginning of the Labor Day weekend, and Sherry Lawton was on the phone when she saw the van driving past all the yellow ribbons and flags, past all the names she refused to forget. "Hold on," she told a relative on the other end of the line. "There's a silver van coming up the driveway." She stopped for a moment, then added, "I don't know anyone with a silver van." "Oh," she said, "it has government plates." When the man in the uniform got out, he was already crying.
Ah, as was obituary writer Sheeler.
Jim Sheeler. Jim Sheeler is he's a wonderful writer, and he puts himself at the service of people. You know, he just wrote an obituary that was not about a soldier. It was about a 105-year-old man who decided when he was 100 years old that he had spent too much of his time paying attention to work and not enough to his children. And if he could have 5 more years, he wanted to get to know his son. And he did.
It just recently wrote that?
Yes.
You see, now you're... I can tell this is breaking
you
up.
Now I'm laughing.
You're laughing.
I'm laughing.
But it gets you. And this so-called egalitarian obituary writing, you say the father of them all, and they tell you the father of them all is Jim Nicholson of Philadelphia. Who's Jim Nicholson?
Jim Nicholson was a wonderful journalist, investigative reporter, who had pretty well burned a lot of bridges by the time he was asked to write obituaries. And he thought maybe that was a good idea. He was working for the Philadelphia Daily News, which was called the People Paper. They called it that. And he said, well, I'll write obituaries about people, not about celebrities, stars, you know, rulers and shakers. I'm going to write about the plumber. I'm going to write about the guy who picks up your garbage. I'm going to write about the woman who taught you third grade and the old woman who sits on the street corner watching the people go by. And he did it with such life and verve and style that it started influencing other people. I mean, here you get 20 inches in a major daily newspaper about someone who had never appeared in the paper in their life.
And Jim Nicholson also did some research when he began this new job. He went back in the archives, and he pointed out to you that this really isn't anything new, that back in the 1800s, they used to write these long, flourishing Gothic novel obits. Mm-hmm. And then we somehow fell away from that. Why was that? Do you know?
I don't really know what happened, but something, the way that the newspapers ended up being was you would get the story of a white man and where he went to school and which jobs he had and who his survivors were. And this was very cut and dried and not very interesting.
When you mention white men, you point out that studies show that women rarely made it into, and still rarely make it into the obituary pages. I think 17 or 20% of the obit pages are women. And you have a quote from Gay Talese.
Women and Negroes hardly ever seem to die.
He wrote that 40 years ago. And is it still true on the obit pages that it's...
I have 2 pages of New York Times obituaries, and there isn't a woman in them.
That's Marilyn Johnson. She's author of The Dead Beat. We'll have more with Marilyn when we come back. And I'm reminded, too, later in the program, we're going to have our own obit for that unknown soldier arriving home on a commercial flight. We still would love to know his name. That story later as well. More after the break here and now. Robin Young, it's here and now. We are keeping one eye on the news for you today, but the other on the obituary pages, looking at the art of obituary writing with Marilyn Johnson. She's the author of the book The Dead Beat, Lost Souls, Lucky Stiffs, and the Perverse Pleasures of Obituaries. We first spoke last year. The book is now out in paperback, and we've been reviewing some of the standouts in the business. I asked Marilyn to comment on the work of Amy Martinez Stark of The Oregonian. Johnson describes Stark as a storyteller disguised as an obituary writer.
What makes Amy's obituaries very interesting to me is that they are sentiment-free. I mean, they really do not seem to be... it's not like she's weeping while she's writing them. She's reporting them.
Right, I've got one here. Sister Anne was a card player and could play pinochle for hours on vacation in Lincoln City with other nuns after morning prayers. She was known for taking a little whiskey neat. And there's another one here. Could you read Amy Martinez Stark's obituary of Ursula King?
Yes, this is the From the beginning of it, Ursula King was considered unruly as a girl. Her father, a strict minister, chastised her for chasing the magnificent police horses through the streets of Lincolnshire, England, and shipped the 10-year-old off to work in an aunt's remote sheep ranch in Australia. A pony she rode to school made up for a lot, but Ursula neglected her chores, and her uncle shot the pony. While she was attending a boarding school in Sydney, a circus came to town. Drawn by the idea of working with horses, Ursula ran away to join the circus.
Now, I open a paper, and I start reading that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got me.
That's a short story.
Yeah. Yeah.
And her uncle shot the pony. I mean, you... I almost can't keep going from there. I just, it's really, to read that in the life of a person who's just left is, I don't know why, to me that's incredible.
Marilyn Johnson, how did you, you read them, you appreciate them, but you write obituaries as well for Princess Diana, Jacqueline Onassis, Katharine Hepburn, for Esquire, Red Book, Life magazine. And, you know, your friends have asked you, and I'm going to ask you the same thing. Where does this come from?
I don't know. I mean, I started reading obituaries. I mean, I know people who died, and I was fascinated by the way that they came back to life on the obituary page.
You had a brother who died very young.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think that's a part of it, maybe, just, you know, wanting to?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I think that really sensitizes you, and you realize at a certain point that... you know, that the world is divided pretty neatly between the people who know that it's going to end in their, you know, in their hearts, and the people who haven't learned that yet. But the stories that we still tell, I mean, he's alive for us, and so are some of the other dear people that I've lost over the years. Mm-hmm. And the obituaries are a way to, it's a way to keep their memory out there. It validates them. You know, to see their stories in the newspaper, and you want those stories to be the best. You want them to evoke them in the most colorful and vivid way.
Well, Americans who never read obits began reading them after 9/11 because of the extraordinary project from the New York Times, and we've spoken to Jenny Scott about the portraits of grief. What struck you as so distinctive about those portraits of those who were killed at 9/11?
Well, they were wonderful. They were wonderful visits. I mean, they really conjured up the people who had gone, and they made, you know, they made hundreds of firemen who all loved their children and coached Little League and loved to eat and cook. They made each one of them stand out. They really got to what made each of us unique, and people read them as an act of honor. I think they would sit down with their coffee in the morning and read them to honor the dead. And you get up, you feel alive, and not just because you've been reading about people who aren't. You feel alive because you see what a life is.
New York's mm-hmm. Newsday also had a collection of the lost, and it was in the
yes.
Tribune papers called American Lives, the stories of the men and women lost on September 11th. The Times was Portraits 9/11/01. Do you have one there that you can...
Okay, this is, yes, I'll read from Newsday's collection of The Lost. Brian O'Flaherty likes to think that his friend Dennis Cross is in heaven, talking about firefighting with Cross's father, who died of a heart attack after battling a major fire when Cross was 13. He probably told his father all the new tactics they now use in the department, O'Flaherty said. They probably laugh at it all because nothing has changed. The fireman still crawls into the building to put out the fire the same way as 50 years ago.
Marilyn Johnson, what have you seen recently that's caught your eye?
Well, I did notice that Caspar Weinberger and Lynn Nofziger went out together.
That's right. You are one of those people who notices that people tend to die in clusters. Reagan advisors Nofziger and Weinberger, or Paul Winchell, the voice of Tigger and Pooh, and John Fiedler, the voice of Piglet, they died a day apart. Or in 1986, the Times ran side-by-side obits of the scientist who isolated vitamin C and the one who isolated vitamin K. Or Presidents John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, both dying on the same 4th of July. The papers at the time, you write, wrote, we remember nothing in the annals of man so striking, so beautiful. It cannot all be by chance.
Yes, yes, yes. They hear their profession called, and they answer the call. In one of the Caspar Weinberger articles, this one by Stephen Miller in the New York Sun, he seized on a detail, which was something that Weinberger kept in a frame on his office wall, a quote from Winston Churchill, "Never give in, never give in, never, 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 in nothing great or small, large or petty, never give in."
That's Marilyn Johnson speaking with us last year. She's author of the book, The Deadbeat, Lost Souls, Lucky Stiffs, and the Perverse Pleasures of Obituaries. It's now out in paperback. Well, taking a quick look ahead at the week ahead, we'll look at Blackwater. It's the company that says it provides the most comprehensive military, law enforcement, security, and peacekeeping operations in the world. Their headquarters in North Carolina are half the size of Manhattan. Well, journalist Jeremy Scahill says Blackwater is the world's most powerful mercenary army, and he wonders, does this kind of outsourcing disguise the true cost of war? We'll speak with him next week. Also next week, we'll review Tom Stoppard's three-play cycle at Lincoln Center. It's The Coast of Utopia. And we'll meet the man credited with making the first album of soul music. That's Solomon Burke. And that's next week. Still ahead, Maine Lobsterman on the big screen. Much more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. For nearly a month now, Pakistani lawyers in suits and ties have been on strike and held rallies. Some have been beaten, tear-gassed, and arrested, and half a dozen judges have resigned because President Pervez Musharraf suspended the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court earlier this month. Musharraf, a strong U.S. ally in the U.S. war on terror, says the Chief Justice was corrupt, but Musharraf's critics say he's trying to stay in power and avoid democratic elections. Well, joining us here in the studio is Hussein Haqqani, a former advisor to three Pakistani prime ministers and now a professor of international relations at Boston University. This week, he testified before Congress about the situation in Pakistan. And, Professor, we're reminded that in your last visit with us, you predicted unrest.
I did.
Yes. And, well, let's remind ourselves how we got here. General Musharraf came to rule after seizing power in 1999. He changed the Constitution so he could be both Army Chief and President, then promised to relinquish his post as Army Chief and run in democratic elections. There are elections scheduled. Then this judge is fired. First, let's get your opinion on this. Is there truth, in your opinion, to the Musharraf claim that this judge was abusing power?
The important thing is that Musharraf appointed this judge barely 2 years ago. The fact of the matter is that Pakistan's judiciary generally has been very sympathetic to the Pakistani military whenever the military takes power. But every now and then there is a judge who says, here is the line. Thus far, no farther. Musharraf has already removed one Supreme Court Chief Justice before. Soon after taking over, he asked all the judges to pledge an oath of loyalty to him before they could decide a case about whether his military takeover was constitutional or legal or not. This time, this particular judge, the Chief Justice, started hearing cases of human rights violations, of massive disappearances, which Musharraf says are necessary for the war against terror, but which Pakistani opposition politicians say are basically a way of intimidating opposition activists. And he annoyed Musharraf. Did he call somebody up about his son's job? I have no way of knowing. But the point is, there is more at stake here.
Well, is it a fear that Musharraf is not going to relinquish his power, his military role?
I don't think that's a fear. I think that's clear. Musharraf has made it clear. Musharraf has said, I am indispensable for Pakistan. The Constitution is not as important as I am for the saving of the country. And one of the big issues is that an army chief serving in uniform cannot be president under the Constitution. Now, Musharraf either has to take off the uniform, become a civilian, but if he becomes a civilian, there's another constitutional bar. The Constitution says that anybody who has served in the military has to wait for 2 years before he can run for political office. And this particular judge was the kind of judge that was likely to say, no, 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 let's go by the Constitution, sir. And Musharraf wanted guarantees that that wouldn't happen.
Well, let's bring the U.S. in here. This sounds like one of those conundrums where the U.S. is backing a leader, Musharraf, who was seen as an ally because of his fight against al-Qaeda, but the U.S. is also pushing democracy, and can they continue to back Musharraf if he's seen as not backing democracy.
Well, the truth is that the U.S. has not been backing democracy in effect. They have just made some noises about it, and I'll just give you an explanation. The U.S. has showered Musharraf with lots of money. There's about $10 billion in U.S. assistance that have gone to Pakistan over the last 5 years. $64 million of $10 billion has been allocated for democracy promotion. And that, too, is going to Musharraf's election commission, a large part of it, not to civil society to be able to change things. So it's amazing that the people who are burning Musharraf's effigies are also burning the effigies of President Bush. The U.S. policy is based on the assumption that Musharraf is the only hope for Pakistan fighting against terrorism. But terrorist attacks inside Pakistan and out of Pakistan into Afghanistan have increased under General Musharraf. Very simply, if the president can just dismiss the Chief Justice, there is no rule of law. If there is no rule of law, then unlawful organizations and groups like terrorists flourish. Instead of trying to make Pakistan stronger and become more a nation of rule of law, by supporting Musharraf, we inadvertently also help the Taliban because they are a lawless bunch who are able to take advantage of the general atmosphere of lawlessness in the country. But that said, the administration's basic plan seems to be to keep General Musharraf in power and at the same time nudge him into doing more against the Taliban and al-Qaeda.
Author Ahmad Rashid writes in the Washington Post that Musharraf is a lame duck. Do you think that's true?
I think that is absolutely true. Look, here are massive protests against him. Lawyers don't like him. Civil society doesn't like him. The fact remains that there is a general environment in which there is a division between the people on the one side and the government and the state on the other. And in that, Musharraf is on the weaker side. And as time goes by, even if he comes out of this crisis, it will not be the Musharraf that went into the crisis, the strong man. He will look weaker.
Well, Rashid also actually recommends that to Musharraf step down while his post-9/11 legacy, such as it was, is still intact, and bring back exiled politicians like the ones that you worked with, Benazir Bhutto. Have you spoken with her, by the way?
Oh, I have indeed. And Ms. Bhutto is planning to return to Pakistan. She is quite ready to go. She's only waiting for what she considers to be the right time. She doesn't want to undercut General Musharraf's efforts against terrorism. So she's trying to balance it, which is coming under criticism. But, you know, political life has its own momentum. If the people start rioting further, then this will become a leaderless riot. And Ms. Bhutto may have to go, and Mr. Sharif, the other Pakistani prime minister who's in exile. The point is, General Musharraf has not filled the political vacuum. Either the political vacuum in Pakistan is filled by Islamists, extremists, or it is filled by Ms. Bhutto and Mr. Sharif because no one else has emerged so far. If there is a moment for U.S. intervention to encourage democracy in Pakistan, it's now, because 5 to 10 to 15 years down the road, we could have a Hamas-like situation. We are not there now, and this is the time to salvage the situation. The alternatives will fall by the wayside if you don't allow them to come back into the game.
So you're saying that you project that that is the future in Pakistan, and I'm interested in hearing that you were just testifying about this, obviously. You met lawmakers who are thinking about a Pakistan post-Musharraf.
Absolutely. I think the State Department is a little slow on this one because they're too invested in General Musharraf. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. policy cannot be just about one man. It should be about an entire nation, and the U.S. needs to look for alternatives. And if the alternatives, and look, the alternatives in politics are those that are available. And so if the only people who are in the arena are Mr. Sharif and Ms. Bhutto, so be it. The point is, Musharraf needs to negotiate with people he has tried to marginalize in the past to try and find a way out that is not just about him, it's about Pakistan. And I think that all the political leadership of Pakistan could come into it, and they would be willing to negotiate. This may be a moment for a grand national bargain in Pakistan.
Hussein Haqqani, Professor of International Relations at Boston University, thank you so much.
It's such a pleasure being here.
Still to come before we go today, more highlights from today's House debate on funding for the war in Iraq. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, a conversation we had here last Friday is still echoing today. You might remember we spoke with John McSheffrey, the Massachusetts man, who told us about his commercial flight, Delta Airlines Flight 1220 on February 27th, that also carried the casket of a soldier who'd been killed in Iraq. The pilot asked passengers to stay seated so an honor guard could remove the flag-draped coffin. And John told us how moved he and other passengers were, how badly they wanted this soldier's family to know that. Well, many of you wrote through tears. Diane Wallace writes, "Our 18-year-old son joined the Army 5 months ago, so his deployment is imminent. I was sobbing listening to your story. To know a soldier died too young and that a family is devastated." Annette Alexander of Lewisburg, North Carolina writes, "As a mother of an Army soldier in Iraq, I had to pull off the road. Soldiers' families work hard to maintain hope as well as a lonely facade of composure. It was comforting to hear how John McSheffrey wants us to know how much Americans love our sons and daughters." And Tiffany Skogstrom of Boston wrote about her late friend Pierre Raymond. She says, "Unlike the unknown soldier in your story, Pierre's family was on board when Pierre's body returned, and they got a standing ovation from the passengers." Well, we'd like to send these many notes to the family of the soldier John saluted, but after a week of searching, producer Alex Ashlock hasn't found a name. He did, though, find many others, and he joins us in the studio. Alex, what do you find?
Well, Robin, I had the phone glued to my ear all week, calling around everywhere. The airline is tied up in privacy issues. They can't release the name to us. But as I trolled around a lot of the different casualty websites that are out there, I did come across a lot of stories that are really worth telling.
Yeah.
And here are just a couple of them. Sergeant Pedro Colon was a homeless teenager in Cicero, Illinois, before he joined the Army. He had left his family back in the Bronx after fighting with his father. This was after his mother had died. But after his death recently, teachers who knew him at Morton East High School told the Chicago Tribune they never even knew he was living on the streets and getting his meals from food pantries. Pedro Colon was on his second tour of Iraq when he was killed by enemy fire in Baghdad on February 19th. He was 25. Mm-hmm. Private Kelly David Youngblood of Mesa, Arizona, always wanted to be in the Army, according to his step-grandmother. She told the East Valley Tribune newspaper that he was always playing Army and wearing camouflage pants when he was a kid. Mm-hmm. But before enlisting, he was like a lot of other teenagers. He enjoyed skateboarding and playing video games with his friends. He had been in Iraq for only 16 days when he was killed by a sniper as he was getting out of the tank he was driving. This was on February 18th. Kelly Youngblood was 19 years old.
You know, Alex, one of the things we heard from so many of our listeners for and against the war in Iraq is that they want to hear these stories. You know, they want to see the flag-draped coffins. We know the Bush administration has not allowed photographs.
That's right.
When the bodies are returned to Dover Air Force Base. But they want to be confronted with the cost of war and honor the family. So share a couple more.
40-year-old Richard L. Ford, he was from East Hartford, Connecticut. He was a big fan of the Boston Red Sox, and he joked that the younger members of his Connecticut National Guard unit called him Grandpa. He was on his third tour of duty when he died from combat wounds on February 20th in Baghdad. And Staff Sergeant David Russell Berry of Wichita, Kansas, and the Kansas National Guard died when his vehicle was hit by an improvised explosive device on February 22nd. He was 37 years old. Just before he was deployed to Iraq, he was awarded the Soldier's Medal. This is the highest peacetime honor a soldier can receive. He had pulled a driver from a burning car after it had crashed. His family said he liked to hunt and was an avid fan of the Wichita Thunder hockey team.
Well, again, your search was prompted by a story about the pilot who asked passengers to stay in their seats so an honor guard could receive the casket of a soldier here in Massachusetts. Now that family may want their privacy. But if not, we'd love that
to
honor that story. And we want to end with something another listener sent. Ann Freeman wrote, "After hearing about a much happier homecoming in which a pilot in Newark asked passengers to remain seated because surviving soldiers were on board, he said, 'Let them go first so they can greet their families.' She wrote this song. Proceeds go to the program to give soldiers frequent flyer miles. To find out more, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Alex, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
More ahead here and now.
Just came home tonight. Let them go first. Don't make them wait. Their families are at the gate. Every minute matters when you're home again. Let them go first. Lend a hand. Show the truths we understand."
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The U.S. House of Representatives has narrowly approved a $124 billion measure that would fund the war in Iraq for the next year and also require combat troops to pull out of Iraq in just over a year. For weeks, Democrats struggled to keep liberal members who wanted to end the war now from voting against the spending bill. Two veterans from different sides of the aisle wrapped up debate this morning. Freshman Democrat Patrick Murphy of Pennsylvania is the only member of Congress who is a veteran of the war in Iraq.
I want to ask you the same questions that my gunner asked me when I was leading a convoy up and down Ambush Alley one day. He said, "Sir, what are we doing over here? What's our mission? When are these Iraqis going to come off the sidelines and stand up for their own country?" So to my colleagues across the aisle, your taunts about supporting our troops ring hollow if you are still unable to answer those questions now, 4 years later.
Then Texas Republican Sam Johnson, who was a prisoner of war in his second tour in Vietnam, rose to remind members of his view of that war.
Starting in 1965, we had folks in Washington trying to tell the generals how to run things on the ground in Vietnam. A generation ago, we saw what happens when you stop the funding and America stiffs its friends. As a matter of fact, we all know just this morning, Iran captured 15 British sailors. This bill prevents us from responding from Kuwait to help our strong allies, the British, in an emergency. We show weakness, and the world knows it. Just think back to the dark day in history when we saw visions of American Marines airlifting Vietnamese out of the U.S. Embassy. You remember that. That's what happens when America makes a commitment. Congress cuts the funding, and we go home with our tails between our legs.
The debate this morning on the Iraq War funding bill, which passed in the House. If a similar bill passes in the Senate, the president has threatened to veto it. Well, our last story for you today, a new independent film shot off the coast of Maine and starring real Maine lobstermen has been making waves in its home state. Well, now the drama is seeping beyond Maine's borders, getting some screenings around the country. Here now is Andrea Shea reports on the unusual course the film Islander has taken from production to the big screen.
A conflict between lobstermen over traps and territory kicks off the drama in Islander.
Mainlander. Same guy was cutting us last year.
Let this mainlander know whose lobster he's stealing.
The rough-hewn central character, Eben Cole, seeks revenge on the mainlander. His rage results in a fatal accident at sea. Eben gets 5 years in prison for manslaughter, but the bulk of the movie explores his difficult return home to Vinylhaven, a tight-knit fishing community. The film was shot on the real Vinylhaven, an island off the rugged Maine coast. Its year-round population is about 1,200, but that number swells in summer when vacationers pack ferries leaving from Rockland Harbor. Lead actor, co-writer, and producer Thomas Hildreth knows the ferry ride well. Driving his rental car through Rockland on the way to show his film, he says he grew up in nearby Portland but summered on Vinylhaven. Now he lives in L.A.
It's not like I was really close to anybody on this island. I would never consider myself a local or a regular or anything like that. But I wanted to recreate something that I felt in my childhood but that I thought would look really cool on film and look real.
To make it real, Hildreth shot on location, as is, with real boats, docks, bars, and weather. But he adds, transforming an island and its working harbor into a movie lot is risky.
If you come in with a whole lot of equipment and you just set up anywhere, people are going to get really put off really quickly, and they'll shut you down. And on a small island, you have nowhere else to go. The island was a major character in the film. It's inherent in the title, but the people of the island were instrumental in getting the film done.
And getting it right. A few Islanders ferried off-island to the Strand Theater for this promotional screening and talkback.
Where are you from?
I'm from Portland. Mm-hmm. Portland, Maine.
Have you ever been a stern man?
No. No, sir, I haven't. I have Jerry Dowdy to thank primarily for helping us make that authentic.
Jerry Doughty's been lobstering for 40 years.
My boat was a camera boat a lot of times.
Doughty also scouted locations and showed the film's cast and crew the ropes of his trade. He shared stories, superstitions, and lingo that ended up in the script. Sternman is another name for lobstermen, for instance, and lobsters are called bugs. Then there's the accent.
What accent? I didn't know we had one up here in Maine.
Lobsterman Walter Day is one of the locals cast in the film. His character is John John, but he pretty much plays himself alongside his peers and some professional actors.
Maybe we should call Terry at the Department of Marine Resources and get him to come out and show them guys where the line is again.
Jesus Christ, John John, we all know where that line is, and they've been pushing it for years. I think it'll show our muscles what they need.
Damn right.
Day helped make the dialogue convincing and says working on a movie was a unique experience, but he's not trading his traps for the trappings of Hollywood.
I kept my day job. I'm a fisherman first. I think I'll stay aboard my boat where there's peace and quiet.
Just about to hit a splice here, so I'm running it slow.
Upstairs in the booth, projectionist Elizabeth McLeod sports white gloves as she cleans and fixes the 35mm print of Islander. She's taking extra care, she says, because it debunks cutesy stereotypes.
Usually when you see Maine people on film, they're salty old customers that go around saying, hey, and yes, sir, and all that for sure. While there is a little bit of truth to that stereotype, a film like this goes beyond that and shows you the real people, the real experience of living in Maine. So yes, we want to make sure the prints is in nice a shape as possible when we send it back.
There are 10 prints of Islander so far, and while it's played at film festivals nationwide where small indie movies sometimes find buyers, distribution companies haven't taken the bait. Even so, Islander made waves in Maine. The thumbs up from Vinyl Haven helped generate interest in Boothbay Harbor, Bangor, Waterville, and Portland. Thomas Hildreth and the other producers wrote it, making calls and posters and buying advertising.
We were always looking for distribution, but we never stopped doing what we were doing. We were test marketing the film, and now we're self-distributing and rolling it out nationwide to select markets, South Florida, D.C., Seattle, Arizona, Denver.
The movie kicked off with a theatrical run in Boston, its first major market. Boston Globe film critic Wesley Morris says Islander's watery tale should play well anywhere.
You know, man screws up, gets out of jail, comes back and wants to get his life back, and it's hard. I don't know, it's pretty classic. In this case, it's a story that could play anywhere. I mean, there are some things that might not travel, but the reason the Islander is moving is because people, I think, recognize its sort of universal elements.
Co-writer and director Ian McCrudden thinks this type of filmmaking will travel, too. He says Islander is the first in a series of community films he hopes to shoot as is in parts of the country that aren't always depicted realistically on film, places where traditional ways of life are under siege. Next stop, Southern Colorado, where McCrudden grew up.
Ranching is not really happening. You've got casinos and you've got like sort of reservation ghettos, and I've written another script that would be made in the same vein as this one, is sort of go in and work with people and in the same way have the cooperation and interest of those people because you need their help to make it right.
And while there might not be much money in making a regional movie like Islander, getting it right for the people who helped make it right is a big payoff, according to Thomas Hildreth.
Those are the guys that the movie's about. So if for them it was authentic and a story worth telling, then we did our job. Anything else is gravy, really.
Real-life Islanders agree that the movie is indeed authentic, but one lobsterman adds this aside. Real sternmen don't swear nearly as much as the characters do on screen.
Here now is Andrea Shea. To see more, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.